Chapter 5, Section 4. Utilization of the excretions of production. The capitalist mode of production extends the utilization of the excretions of production and consumption. By the former, we mean the waste of industry and agriculture. By the latter, partly the excretions produced by the natural exchange of matter in the human body, and partly the form of objects that remains after their consumption. In the chemical industry, for instance, excretions of production are such byproducts as are wasted in production on a smaller scale. Iron filings accumulating in the manufacture of machinery and returning into the production of iron as raw material, etc. Excretions of consumption are the natural waste matter discharged by the human body, remains of clothing in the form of rags, etc. Excretions of consumption are of the greatest importance for agriculture. So far as their utilization is concerned, there is an enormous waste of them in the capitalist economy. In London, for instance, they find no better use for the excretion of 4.5 million human beings than to contaminate the Thames with it at heavy expense. Rising prices of raw materials naturally stimulate the utilization of waste products. The general requirements for the re-employment of these excretions are large quantities of such waste, such as are available only in large-scale production, improved machinery, whereby materials, formerly useless in their prevailing form, are put into a state fit for new production, scientific progress, particularly of chemistry, which reveals the useful properties of such waste. It is true that great savings of this sort are also observed in small-scale agriculture, as prevails in, say, Lombardy, southern China, and Japan. But on the whole, the productivity of agriculture under this system obtains from the prodigal use of human labour power, which is withheld from other spheres of production. The so-called waste plays an important role in almost every industry. Thus, the factory report for December 1863 mentions as one of the principal reasons why the English and many of the Irish farmers do not like to grow flax, or do so but rarely, quote, "the great waste which has taken place at the little water scutch mills. The waste in cotton is comparatively small, but in flax very large. The efficiency of water steeping and of good machine scutching will reduce this disadvantage very considerably. Flax, scutched in Ireland in a most shameful way, and a large percentage actually lost by it, equal to 28% or 30%, unquote, reports of the Inspector of Factories, December 1863. Whereas all this might be avoided through the use of better machinery. So much tow fell by the wayside that the factory inspector reports, quote, "I have been informed with regard to some of the scutch mills in Ireland that the waste made at them has often been used by the scutchers to burn on their fires at home, and yet is very valuable," unquote. We shall speak of cotton waste later, when we deal with the price fluctuations of raw materials. The wool industry was shrewder than the flax manufacturers. Quote, "It was once the common practice to decry the preparation of waste and woolen rags for remanufacture, but the prejudice has entirely subsided as regards the shoddy trade, which has become an important branch of the woolen trade of Yorkshire, and doubtless the cotton waste trade will be recognised in the same manner as supplying an admitted want. 30 years since, woolen rags, that is, pieces of cloth, old clothes, etc., of nothing but wool, would average about £4.4 per ton in price. Within the last few years they have become worth £44 per ton, and the demand for them has so increased that means have been found for utilizing the rags of fabrics of cotton and wool mixed by destroying the cotton and leaving the wool intact, and now thousands of operatives are engaged in the manufacture of shoddy, from which the consumer has greatly benefited in being able to purchase cloth of a fair and average quality at a very moderate price. Unquote. Reports of the Inspector of Factories, October 1863. By the end of 1862, the rejuvenated shoddy made up as much as one-third of the entire consumption of wool in the English industry. Reports of the Inspector of Factories, October 1862. The big benefit for the consumer is that his shoddy clothes wear out in just one-third of the previous time, and turn threadbare in one-sixth of this time. The English silk industry moved along the same downward path. The consumption of genuine raw silk decreased somewhat between 1839 and 1862, while that of silk waste doubled. Improved machinery helped to manufacture a silk useful for many purposes from this otherwise rather worthless stuff. The most striking example of utilizing waste is furnished by the chemical industry. It utilizes not only its own waste, for which it finds new uses, but also that of many other industries. For instance, it converts the formerly almost useless gas tar into aniline dyes, alizarin, and more recently, even into drugs. This economy of the excretions of production through their re-employment is to be distinguished from economy through the prevention of waste. That is to say, the reduction of excretions of production to a minimum, and the immediate utilization to a maximum of all raw and auxiliary materials required in production. Reduction of waste depends in part on the quality of the machinery in use. Economy in oil, soap, etc. depends on how well the mechanical parts are machined and polished. This refers to the auxiliary materials. In part, however, and this is most important, it depends on the quality of the employed machines and tools, whether a larger or smaller portion of the raw material is turned into waste in the production process. Finally, this depends on the quality of the raw material itself. This, in turn, depends partly on the development of the extractive industry and agriculture which produce the raw material, strictly speaking, on the progress of civilization, and partly on the improvement of processes through which raw materials pass before they enter into manufacture. Quote, Parmentier has demonstrated that the art of grinding grain has improved very materially in France since a none too distant epoch, for instance the time of Louis XIV, so that the new mills, compared to the old, can make up to half as much more bread from the same amount of grain. The annual consumption of a Parisian, indeed, has first been estimated at 4 setiers of grain, then at 3, finally at 2. While nowadays it is only 1 1/3 setiers, or about 342 pounds per capita. In the Perche, where I have lived for a long time, the crude mills of granite and trap-rock millstones have been mostly rebuilt according to the rules of mechanics which has made such rapid progress in the last 30 years. They have been provided with good millstones from La Ferté, have ground the grain twice, the milling sack has been given a circular motion, and the output of flour from the same amount of grain has increased one-sixth. The enormous discrepancy between the daily grain consumption of the Romans and ourselves is therefore easily explained. It is due simply to imperfect methods of milling and bread-making. This is the way I feel I must explain a remarkable observation made by Pliny. Quote, the flour was sold in Rome, depending on its quality, at 40, 48, or 96 ars per modius. These prices, so high in proportion to the contemporaneous grain prices, are due to the imperfect state of the mills of that period, which were still in their infancy, and the resultant heavy cost of milling. Durand de la Malle, Économie politique des Romains, Paris, 1840. Chapter 5, Section 5. Economy through inventions. These savings in the application of fixed capital are, we repeat, due to the employment of the conditions of labour on a large scale. In short, are due to the fact that these serve as conditions of directly social, or socialised labour, or direct cooperation within the process of production. On the one hand, this is the indispensable requirement for the utilisation of mechanical and chemical inventions without increasing the price of the commodity, and this is always the conditio sine qua non. On the other hand, only production on a large scale permits the savings derived from cooperative productive consumption. Finally, it is only the experience of the combined labourer which discovers and reveals the where and how of saving, the simplest methods of applying the discoveries, and the ways to overcome the practical frictions arising from carrying out the theory, in its application to the production process, etc. Incidentally, a distinction should be made between universal labour and cooperative labour. Both kinds play their role in the process of production, both flow one into the other, but both are also differentiated. Universal labour is all scientific labour, all discovery and all invention. This labour depends partly on the cooperation of the living and partly on the utilisation of the labours of those who have gone before. Cooperative labour, on the other hand, is the direct cooperation of individuals. The foregoing is corroborated by frequent observation. To wit, 1. The great difference in the cost of the first model of a new machine and that of its reproduction, regarding which, see Ewer, The Philosophy of Manufactures, 2nd edition, London, 1855, and Babbage, On the Economy of Machinery and Manufactures, London, 1832. 2. The far greater cost of operating an establishment based on a new invention as compared to later establishments arising ex suis ossibus. This is so very true that the trailblazers generally go bankrupt, and only those who later buy the buildings, machinery, etc., at a cheaper price make money out of it. It is, therefore, generally the most worthless and miserable sort of money capitalists who draw the greatest profit out of all new developments of the universal labour of the human spirit and their social application through combined labour. 3.